Welcome, this is William Evans and we're Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Florence Kaplow, minister for Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist Church here in Carbondale. Welcome, Florence.
Thank you.
Life is a mystery that seems to me to be built on peaceful exchanges and relationships.
Is that, that's your theory of life?
That's an observation.
Well, I would say life is a mystery. I'd agree with you there. I would say, however, that our relationships run the range, the gamut, from peaceful to deeply antagonized. And that's part of our work as human beings, is to heal and work with relationships when they're not peaceful.
Well, I would say, in follow-up to my opening line, that at the same time I see a lot of steady, peaceful exchanges, I have witnessed that life feeds on life in a continuous cycle of death and violence.
Yes, I agree. And I agree that also many of our exchanges with one another are peaceful. And one of the things that I've been interested in as I've read and thought about nonviolence over the years is that reality is that many of us experience on a daily basis mostly peaceful and nonviolent exchanges with other human beings. And yet through the media and the news, we can easily begin to feel that human beings are just hopelessly violent and hateful, when in fact our direct experience is more nuanced than that.
And the reason I led with the line I did is I know you have some experience with plants, and a lot of the life-sustaining work of plants is a very peaceful, steady state.
Well, that's definitely true. In fact, I used to say that my background is as a botanist before I went into the ministry, and I used to say that I suspected that we might have the whole evolutionary thing upside down, and that in fact plants are a much more highly evolved form, because after all, they figured out a way to take solar energy and turn it into matter, and to do it very peacefully. And they also know how to sit still and work with the conditions that they're given, which we're not so good at doing.
Yes. I would enjoy hearing you talk a little bit about the Leningrad Seed Bank.
Oh, yes. This is something I've been interested in for a while. So this is a story that may be familiar to some people listening to this. Back in the 20s and 30s, before World War II, one of the great seed banks of the world was developed. And seed banks are very, very important for all kinds of research work, but particularly agricultural seed banks are important because they are the place where the great genetic diversity of our agricultural systems are stored. And the Soviet Union was aware that it was very important to have such a seed bank for all of the plants that were grown in Russia and throughout Europe and the East. And so this extraordinary seed bank had developed there with many scientists who worked to, some of those seeds had to be grown out regularly to make sure that everything was still functioning with the seed bank. And then during the siege of Leningrad, which was, do you remember the year?
It was World War II.
Right, but it 1940, I don't know, maybe
probably 44.
Yeah, I think it was 44. The Germans surrounded Leningrad for more than a year, and literally millions of people starved in the siege of Leningrad. And after the war, it was discovered that many of the scientists, many of whom were women, actually, who were in charge of the great seed bank of Leningrad, knew that if those seeds were found and eaten, and again, these were agricultural seeds, that a great loss would occur for the future. And so they protected the seed bank, most of the seed bank, hid it, and protected it with their own lives. And I believe 9 of them died of starvation, the scientists, rather than eat the seeds of the future. And so to me, it's one of the great stories of human conscience and the ability to sacrifice oneself for the sake of the future, for the sake of a larger good, not knowing what would happen. And in fact, the seeds of the Leningrad seed bank did survive the siege. And the seed bank continues to this day.
And you've had a longstanding interest in peace, and that would continue as well. Would you talk to us about peace?
Well, it's a pretty big subject. Maybe I'll just say a little bit about some of my own involvement and interest. Even as a child, and you know, it's interesting, I don't know what determines how a child sees the world. But I think perhaps because I spent part of my childhood in Europe, I am the daughter of an art historian who did her research in Italy starting in the 1960s, and she would take me there. And in the 1960s in Italy, there were still lots of signs of the scars of World War II, both in the buildings and on the streets, but also in the human beings, in the Italians themselves. And my mother's closest friend was an Italian woman who had survived the war as a young girl and teenager. And so I heard those stories firsthand. And that gave me a very strong sense that I think probably most American children don't have of the horrors of war and of the tremendous importance to finding a way of living in peace, both personally and how we are in the world, but also societally and even globally. And my father actually also, he was one of the first Americans to enter Hiroshima after the nuclear bomb was dropped. And he was a sociologist, and he wrote extensively about his own belief in the possibility of world peace and the necessity for world peace, for our survival.
So you grew up with a sensitivity of war and an awareness of peace.
Yes, yeah. And I think that because of my background also in Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and contemplative practices, I see the process of peace as being something that has to happen at all levels. So I think anybody who lived through the 60s probably knew lots of people who were out there demonstrating for peace in Vietnam while perhaps not exactly living peacefully in how they treated each other or how they treated the police that they came into contact with. And that actually, I think what we've learned over the decades is that peace needs to be happening at all those levels simultaneously. So one response is to say, oh, I'll just take care of my individual peace. I'll just block out the rest of the world. But of course, we're interconnected. We're intimate with the whole world. And so actually, we can't do either. We can't either give up on the possibility of world peace and continuing to work for that. But we also have to do the deep and sometimes very difficult inner work of creating peace in our relationships, in our family, and in our own heart, in how we are with how the world is. So I see those two processes as something we have to be engaged in together, not as separate kinds of work.
Yeah, as you begin, you use the word practice. And I'm trained in contest behavior as a product of this culture. And so it's a big practice for me to replace my reflex of responding to a challenge in a contest behavior with a presence of peace and thousands of hours. And I'm not making as much progress as I would like, but I'm committed.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really important point, that part of living a life of peace or nonviolence is to make a commitment to it, knowing that we are imperfect creatures and that we will fail in many ways in that commitment, and yet to return to that commitment as something that is a foundation or a strong intention in your life. I think that is the beginning of making peace. I believe that's true. And that it's a returning to that intention over and over again. And in also in, again, at those different levels, both personal and political.
And that commitment can be amazing when it's collective. Tell us about the miracle of Leipzig.
Well, this is another story that I really love, because I think it says something about the power of nonviolence, actually, which I think we tend to poo-poo a little bit in our social, political, intellectual realms. We tend to think, oh yes, it's the power of force that wins out in the end, not the power of nonviolence. And this story is really striking in that way, because it is a very direct example of the power of nonviolence. So in 1989, the Berlin Wall was still in place across Germany, and it seemed that the power of the wall was inviolable, that it would never come down. I don't think a single person, probably in either the East or the West, would have said, oh yes, that wall's coming down in the next year. Didn't seem possible. Been there for a long time. And Leipzig, which is in East Germany, was a city, like many of the cities in East Germany, really dominated by the Stasi, by the secret police. People were under surveillance at all times. They lived in a true police authoritarian state. So it was a very frightening place to stand up for what you believe. Over the course of some months, actually starting maybe a year before, small groups of people who were connected with the churches and with liberal organizations in Leipzig began to conduct small street protests. They were small enough that they weren't really coming to the attention of the Stasi very directly. And then in October of 1989, the whole movement just exploded in Leipzig. And it culminated in a street protest that no one realized was going to be as large as it ended up being. It actually ended up being 70,000 people on the streets of Leipzig. And the military had surrounded the city. The expectation was that there was going to be tremendous bloodshed. Again, we can't imagine what it would be like to be living in a police state. But the stories are that couples split up so that if one of them was killed, the other one would survive for their children. Young people said goodbye to their families, assuming that they might never see them again. But for the people of Leipzig, the degree of oppression and authoritarianism that they were living under was no longer tolerable. And so they went into the streets. And the odd thing, the reason I know about this story, just a few months ago, one of the main protagonists of the story, Kurt Masur, who was the conductor of the New York City Philharmonic for many years, died. And in listening to the radio, where they were talking about his life, they talked about his role in the miracle of Leipzig. He was a conductor of a prestigious orchestra in Leipzig. He said himself that for most of the period of the Berlin Wall, he stayed away from politics. He just stayed with his music and what he loved and tried to ignore the situation that he was living under. But that day, when he heard that there could be thousands of people who would die in the streets of Leipzig, in his beloved city, he was approached by one of the members of the one of the underground organizations that was organizing this, and he was very highly regarded. East Germany was a place where musicians and poets and writers were held in high regard, probably higher than we do. And he was asked if he could help. And so he called together an emergency meeting of a small group of people, which included some Communist Party or the head of the ruling party in East Germany. And there was, a cabaret singer as part of this group. Anyway, this small group of people to try to figure out what they could do to stop the violence. At that point, they didn't know how large the demonstration was going to be, but they knew that the military had the city surrounded. And they made a decision that Kurt Masur would speak over a loudspeaker system into the streets of Leipzig, calling for peace and nonviolence, which he did. And much to everybody's amazement, not a shot was fired that day. And what is even more extraordinary is that no one to this day knows why the military did not open fire on those demonstrators. But it was the beginning of what was called the Peaceful Revolution. And literally months later, the Berlin Wall came down against all the predictions of every pundit in the East and West. The Berlin Wall came down. And I think it's really important to remember that these things are possible in our world, even when we might have a thousand talking heads telling us that it's not so.
And Honecker resigned.
That's right. That's right. Within days
yeah.
of that event. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite definitions of health is that health's proportional to the number of perceived options available. And when I'm caught in my training in contest behavior, I think I'm either a defender, an aggressor, or a victim. And I don't realize there's this other possibility, this other option that is a lot more fun, more challenging, and takes more training and discipline.
Mm-hmm. That's beautifully put. I mean, so when you say those three roles, I think of our fight or flight responses, right? The kind of basic, even pre-mammalian responses. There's also the possibility of sitting down on the foundation of your own conscience and acting from love, which is an entirely different, I think, a different part of the brain and a very different and radical response.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Florence Kaplow about peace. Yes, and that... that love, in many ways, is the organizing principle of the universe.
Yeah, I'm not as a. I don't know what the organizing principle of the universe is, but I do think wherever it is that love has come from, whatever mystery has produced love, and whether it's universal or something that has arisen within us or. Who knows? Maybe we're the only place in the universe where love has arisen, which would make it all the more important to survive as a species. But whatever it is, I think it's one of the great miracles, actually, of being human, that we have this capacity to sacrifice even our own lives for the sake of love for another, sometimes even a stranger.
Well, and when I say what I did in terms of an organizing principle, I think we see it in animals, and I believe it exists in plants.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is definitely there in animals, too. I think no one who has had a close relationship with a dog or a cat or a horse or even a guinea pig could say that animals are not capable of love, because I think actually what we generally experience in relationship with animals is a capacity for love, for unconditional love, that in fact puts our human attempts at love somewhat in the shadows. So yes, I agree. What I mean is we don't know where it came from, that great capacity, and it's precious.
And that's part of the mystery.
Right. Yeah.
So would you talk a little bit about cultivating your own loving peacefulness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, a UU minister, fellow UU minister, who's also a Buddhist practitioner, has a series of, I forget what he calls them, but platforms for peaceful action in the world. And one of the things he says, and I would very much agree with this, is that the most important aspect, most important quality that we can develop that can lead towards peaceful action is compassion. And that when we develop compassion for ourselves and for other people, that, and I would agree directly in my own experience, makes it more and more impossible to cause harm deliberately to others. That when you have touched the realities of the human experience, which is that we are tremendously vulnerable creatures. We all want to be happy. Some of us have very strange ways of going about it, but we all want that. And that there's a lot of suffering in life. And when you know that directly, and I know from many years of meditation practice and long retreat practice, long time in silence, where I was really able to see that directly in my own life, it has softened my heart to others, knowing that, as it's sometimes said, we are each fighting a great battle, and not a battle in the sense of a warlike battle, but that life is hard, life is difficult. And so why would you want to live your life in any other way other than bringing greater goodness into the world and less pain, rather than adding to the pain of the people who are walking around and that you're coming into contact with? And so I feel like some kind of contemplative practice, and it takes a lot of different forms for different people, can be tremendously helpful for opening the heart. Because I think ultimately peace is a practice of the heart, not of the mind.
I agree. So tell us what happens when you're in a field of unnecessary violence.
Hmm.
What goes on inside you and outside you?
Well, the thing that I feel that I can bring to a situation like that is my own groundedness. So if I'm in a situation that's a very heightened situation, the first thing I'm going to try to do is actually reconnect with my own basic calmness, what in Zen is sometimes called big mind. And I know the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who was very much in the center of the Vietnam War and has been a Nobel Peace Prize. I don't think he's won, but he's been nominated and spent his life working for peace. One of the things he always says is, "Well, you know, when the Vietnamese boat people were in the boats trying to cross to safety, they were in these tiny rickety boats, much like the situation of Syrian refugees right now in the Mediterranean, that would, and they were menaced by pirates and high seas." And if just one person on the boat could stay calm, it could make the difference between life and death for everybody on the boat. And that's, if we choose to take it up, that's our job, to become the person in the boat who can stay calm. And so I've seen that over and over again, that in especially being in positions of leadership within communities, within a UU congregation, being a minister, being a Zen practitioner, teacher, priest, that if one person can stay calm, if I can stay calm, genuinely grounded, in a sense, it's like an electrical outlet. You know, if it has a ground, it's not going to blow up on you. And I mean, that's not a guarantee, but I think groundedness and courage are the two words that come to mind for me. Being willing to be in the mud, in the mess. Sometimes people who are spiritual want to kind of do what's sometimes called a spiritual bypass and just pretend that life isn't as messy as it is. Life isn't as difficult as it is. And I think part of being a peacemaker is being willing to face just how messy things can really be and be willing to be in there and maybe even to get caught up in it. And then hopefully to be able to step back and remember again what your primary commitment is, what your primary intention is, and be a helpful presence in that situation instead of adding to the fire. So that's what I would say. And it's not easy work.
Thank you, Florence. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
This is William Evans. I've been speaking with Florence Kaplow about peace. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.